Good morning. I'm very happy to see all of you. It's a wonderful spring day in Chicago. I'm Jean Marsh, the Dean of the School of Social Service Administration, and it's my very distinct pleasure to welcome all of you to this sixth SSA Centennial Symposium, where we will be discussing the very important issues of America's and Chicago's health safety net. But first, there are many people to thank for the work that's been done in preparation for this symposium. In particular, I'd like to thank faculty members Colleen Grogan and Harold Pollack, and all of our distinguished panelists. I'd also like to thank the chair of our centennial extravaganza, Dodie Norton, who's here today, who has really presided over and provided wonderful leadership to a range of events and activities that have involved numerous faculty, students, alumni, and distinguished guests to the university. I would also thank the symposia co-chair for all of these symposia, Sydney Hans and Julie Henley. And I believe on your program, the additional faculty, staff, and alumni who have been working very hard on our sets of alumni events are listed there. And so we thank all of them for the energy and inspiration that have made these events possible. I'd also like to thank Ted Snyder of the Booth School, Susan Mayer of the Harris School of Public Policy, and Dr. Jim Madera, Dean of Biological Sciences and the Pritzker School of Medicine, who oversee our joint graduate program in Health Administration and Policy, fondly known as the GFAP program. This program exemplifies the interdisciplinary approach that the University of Chicago has toward research and education in healthcare, healthcare reform, and health policy. We'd also like to thank the Medical Center for their continued partnership through the Erickson Fellowships in offering our students summer internships in hospital administration. This has been a tremendous centennial year, which we really launched in the spring quarter of last year and formally launched in November when President Zimmer was here in our resplendent banner-filled lobby to launch what has been an amazing set of events. This, as I mentioned, is the sixth of 10 academic symposia. We've had three Harper lectures, a conference on gangs and urban violence, multiple alumni events across the country, and we're planning and looking forward to a closing gala for civic leadership in June on Alumni Weekend. We hope you'll all come back for that as well. Edith and Grace Abbott, Sophie Nisba Breckenridge, Marion Talbot, many of whom are hanging in honor before you, as well as such luminaries as Michael Davis, would be proud to see the vast accomplishments of the people who've given shape to the field of social welfare, and in particular, those who dedicate their research and careers to improving access to all to quality health care. Reflecting briefly on our historical roots, 100 years ago, William Rainey Harper, president of the University of Chicago, defined SSA as an institution committed both to rigorous standards of research and inquiry and to open engagement in American society. Harper once said, "Democracy has scarcely begun to understand itself. It is for the university, as a center of thought, to maintain and advance the ideas and ideals so essential to the success of democracy." Harper understood that the dynamic exchange between the university and the world beyond the campus was critical to the development of knowledge in medicine, sociology, human development, economics, and in particular to the School of Social Service Administration. This combined focus on rigorous inquiry and civic engagement was catalytic in the development of this school, this Chicago School of Social Service Administration, The pioneering efforts of SSA's founding mothers, Edith and Grace Abbott and Sophie Nisba Breckinridge, in the policy areas of public health, immigration, child welfare, and labor helped very much, in Harper's words, democracy to understand itself. Many of our presidents during the early 20th century were innovative in addressing the growing social problems in our burgeoning democracy. President William Howard Taft established the Children's Bureau in 1912 to study and administer programs for issues such as infant and child mortality, children's health, child labor, aid to mothers. In 1921, the Shepherd Tower Maternity and Infancy Protection Act was passed, which coordinated state and federal aid to promote the health of mothers and children. And in the same year, President Warren Harding appointed Grace Abbott as the head of the Children's Bureau. In a 1922 report, Grace Abbott reviewed the first decade of the Bureau's work and stated, "There has been an increasing appreciation of the importance of technique in the field of child care, of linking the state with local administrative machinery, and of including the field of interest in the field of interest all children in the community. The medical profession is giving more consideration to the social and economic aspects of health, and social workers have learned the importance of physical diagnosis before determining social treatment. The Children's Bureau does not claim responsibility for these changes. It can, however, be said that its investigations furnished the facts on which action was frequently based. And because of the cooperation of experts in child welfare, public and private child caring agencies, and women's organizations, the Bureau has been able to focus national attention on some of the most important aspects of child health." So these quotes remind us that the tradition of rigorous scholarship and preparation of leaders in healthcare and social work is a long and distinguished tradition in this school. These investigations would eventually inform the work of Grace in the development of Titles 4 and 5 of the Social Security Act that was signed into law by Roosevelt, of course, in 1935. As you all know, Grace's sister, Edith Abbott, was the first female dean of SSA and of any graduate school in the United States, and Sophie Nisba Breckinridge was the first female graduate of the University of Chicago Law School. The collective work of these women and others helped professionalize and secularize the profession of social work and laid the foundations for a mode of inquiry and practice that emphasized rigorous social science research to illuminate and ameliorate serious social problems, and to formulate effective public policy. SSA faculty, researchers, students, and alumni carry forward this tradition, as evidenced in our presentations today. In 1934, during this period of innovation in social and health care in the U.S., Michael M. Davis, an innovator in hospital administration and an advocate for new methods of delivering and paying for medical care, helped change and improve health education and administration with a bold proposal to the University of Chicago. Through the support of deans of the Graduate School of Business, the medical school, and the faculties in the Department of Sociology and SSA, he started a program in hospital administration which was the first of its kind in the world. It taught students organizational management, accounting, administrative statistics, and procurement. This program is now known as the Graduate Program in Health Administration and Policy, and since the 30s has expanded to include more emphasis on social service and public policy. And to reflect this broader emphasis, it was with the distinguished leadership of Ron Anderson that the GFAC program moved from being housed in the what was then called the Graduate School of Business, to being housed in SSA while still maintaining its broad interdisciplinary emphasis. Since that time, and really since 1963, CHAZ has hosted, in honor of Michael Davis' remarkable work, the Michael Davis Lecture Series, a series that was established as a forum for free and open inquiry into the social and economic aspects of medical care. Jim Marone, one of our panelists, has been a presenter in this series. So we credit these great pioneers in health and social welfare as helping to make SSA a top-ranked graduate school of social work in the country. And we have been, for example, one of the only training programs in maternal and child health funded by the Public Health Service. And each year, our students learn their profession while providing 250,000 hours, often unpaid service in clinical administrative field placements for agencies throughout the Chicago area. This includes field placements at Chicago's top health agencies, programs, and hospitals. SSA faculty and alumni guide our students while working at the intersection of scholarship, research, and policy and practice to do the work necessary to lessen inequality and injustice. And we foster this activity through the sort of community engagement reflected in this symposium. So in conclusion, I thank Professors Grogan and Pollack for their leadership in creating this event. And it's my very great pleasure now to introduce Professor Colleen Grogan. Thank you, Colleen.
Thank you, Jane. Welcome, everybody. Good morning. And what a glorious morning it is. I am so pleased that the weather is cooperating for our out-of-town speakers and guests. But I must confess I'm most pleased for my fellow Chicagoans. I was beginning to worry about our mental health. It's been a very long winter. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Colleen Grogan, as Jane said. I'm associate professor at SSA and also the faculty chair of the Graduate Program in Health Administration and Policy, or GFAP. I'll be moderating this morning's first panel, which is titled A Critique of the American Safety Net, Lessons from the Past to Inform the Future. Speaking today will be Beatrice Hoffman, Department Chair and Associate Professor of History at Northern Illinois University, right here to my left, and Rosemary Stevens, DeWitt Wallace Distinguished Scholar for Social Medicine and Public Policy at Weill Cornell Medical College Department of Psychiatry, and Stanley I. Scheer Professor Emeritus in Arts and Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. Our speakers' full biographies can be found in your program, but I'd like to provide a brief introduction here to highlight their amazing work. Professor Hoffman will talk first, and so I will introduce her, and then following her talk, I will introduce Professor Stevens. Professor Hoffman's fields of study include legal, constitutional, and medical policy, as well as social movements in 20th century United States. I am most familiar with her work on the history of medical policy in the U.S., and highly recommend her book, The Wages of Sickness, The Politics of Health Insurance in Progressive America. For anyone wanting to understand the factors that originally shaped our thinking about compulsory or government-run health insurance, how we thought about deservingness of health benefits, this book is a must-read. Since that work, Professor Hoffman received an RWJ Investigator Award to explore the history of the right to health care. Based on this research, she has published several articles and chapters on the history of health insurance, emergency rooms, and healthcare activism. I met Beatrice about 10 years ago now when she first started this work, and I was fascinated then and continue to be as new work emerges as to how Americans conceptualize the right to healthcare over time, the way these notions have changed and yet in important ways have stayed the same. It is from this large body of work that Beatrice will draw from today, and I know we are all in for a treat. So it is my great pleasure to welcome Professor Beatrice Hoffman.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Colleen, for that lovely introduction. I really, excuse me, just had a little too much coffee, I guess. But I really am grateful to Colleen and to Harold for inviting me here today. It is such an honor to be at this event, also to be on a panel with Rosemary Stevens, whose work continues to inspire me and also, I think, all historians of American healthcare. To be here at the SSA is particularly, it's a thrill for me as a historian of healthcare policy and the American welfare state to see the names up here, to meet people who've worked with folks like Odin Anderson and even people who knew or had met Michael Davis. To me, it's just like
coming to the place where it all started. And also you have a very beautiful space here with a lot of natural light. So I really appreciate being invited here. This is a place dedicated to wrestling with and confronting social problems, including those problems that we don't seem to be able to solve, or in the case of healthcare, we try over and over again to solve them, only to meet with defeat. And today, in our nation's history, we're at a moment that has occurred repeatedly in the past century. We're again on the brink of major national healthcare reform. But the burden on President Obama's shoulders, I think we all realize, is probably greater than that of any other U.S. president who has tried to fix healthcare. And that is because we're also counting on him to fix the economy at the same time. So can historians solve this problem for him? Probably not. And I'm still waiting for that call from Washington. They haven't called yet. There are clear limits to what history can offer. But I did think a lot about what I could speak to you about today and what lessons from my research, as Colleen described, my research on the history of the right to health care, could best help us look to the future of the health care safety net. And so I've decided to talk about what happened here in Chicago to the existing safety net in the midst of another economic crisis, the Great Depression. And I'll be telling some stories today about what was really almost the sole safety net in Chicago at the time. And these are the outpatient clinics, they were also known as dispensaries, that had served the city's poor and working class since the end of the 19th century. And I'm going to describe what was called at the time, during the Depression, the clinic crisis, which is what happened when these clinics became flooded with patients during this time of very high unemployment in the 30s, people who could suddenly no longer afford private medical care. So the clinic crisis that I'm going to talk about today revealed a huge demand for free and accessible health care, and as a result, it led to new demands for state and even federal support for this safety net. So I'm going to talk about these clinics today with an emphasis on something else I try to do in my most recent work, which is to recreate with fairly limited evidence what it was like for ordinary people at the time to seek health care. And I was especially eager to share this with this audience today because I wanted to note the importance of the School of Social Service Administration to historians like myself. One of the best places where we can find actual stories of ordinary people and their experiences with healthcare and welfare institutions is in the master's theses that were written by graduates of this school as far back as the 1920s. And they're housed in the Regenstein Library here. At least I've seen some of them there. And that's where I found many stories and even some actual words of poor and working people because of the fieldwork that was done by students of this school. Many, many decades ago. So on behalf of the history profession, I thank you to SSA. A little bit of background on the clinic system. What were these clinics? Maybe some of you are familiar with them. Maybe some of you even work in them today, and I really look forward to hearing your own stories. But the clinics of Chicago originated in the 19th century. All major U.S. cities had them. Most were affiliated with teaching hospitals originally, and their most important function was in the training of doctors. It was not so much about providing health care. It was about providing clinical material to physicians in training. Around the turn of the 20th century, though, the clinics began to take on more of what we would now see as a safety net function. They began to be considered a crucial means of health care delivery for populations who could not pay for private care. And Chicago had a fairly well-developed clinic system, not as extensive as New York or Philadelphia, but they had a wide variety of different types of clinics that the poor could go to, ranging from a municipal tuberculosis clinic run by the city that was completely publicly funded to the outpatient departments of private hospitals, such as Michael Reese and, of course, the University of Chicago. The clinics had paid staff and nurses, but physicians were expected to offer their services free of charge. Originally, the clinics were entirely free to patients, but by the 30s, about a third of the clinics in Chicago charged some sort of fee to their patients, usually sliding scale, and this was an idea that originated with Michael Davis of the University of Chicago.
It was his idea to start charging modest fees at some clinics in order to expand the number of patients who would be eligible for care, because the working poor, people with any income at all, were not eligible for the free care. So he thought of the idea of paid clinics as a way of bringing in more working class people to this type of health care. And as you can see from this description, the clinics were a great example of what Rosemary Stevens has identified as the dual public-private nature of American health care. And another example of this public-private aspect is that all of these clinics, whether they were public, nonprofit, or private, operated under the umbrella of a private social service agency, the Council of Social Agencies of Chicago. So clinic service was available usually on a walk-in basis for Chicagoans who were not sick enough to be hospitalized, but could not pay a private doctor in the home or the office. The clinics treated a very wide range of conditions, from venereal disease to TB to broken bones. Some offered prenatal care. Children's Memorial had a pediatric clinic. Overcrowding was often a problem, especially because the clinics were open only very limited hours. But in order not to ruffle the feathers of the medical profession was very wary of the clinics and saw them as potential competitors. So the clinics were deliberately designed to reach a fairly limited clientele. Facilities were very strict about who was allowed to come in for treatment, and most of them employed social workers to investigate the family budgets of patients to make sure they could not afford a private doctor. But the Great Depression really thrust these clinics into a much more prominent role than Chicago charity workers and the medical profession had ever expected. And the crash, the stock market crash and subsequent depression, hit this city very hard. 50% of Chicago's factory workers lost their jobs by 1933. Public school teachers went for months without pay. One historian described Chicago early in the Depression years with the following image. 1,500 to 2,000 people would line up two blocks long to receive bread, coffee, and alternate days meat at the bread lines. Homeless men erected shanties on scattered vacant lots throughout the city. Hundreds of children came to school without breakfast, existing on one meal per day. These images of the Depression are probably more familiar, but we have heard much less about what it was like for the people who were unemployed to try to seek medical care. So this is what I tried to find out and was able to get some really rich information, like I said, from the sources available in the city. So here's the picture I came up with. Chicago clinics experienced a drastic increase in demand almost immediately at the very beginning of the Depression. In some points of the Depression, they were getting about double the caseload that they had expected in the 1920s. In 1931, the Council of Social Agencies, the CSA, reported, just a few examples, that the U of I clinic is working to capacity 125 visits for the full current year. Municipal TB sanatorium averaging 25,000 visits a month. Visits to St. Luke's Hospital Clinic had risen by 10,000 in just 1 year, and the hospital was forced to impose drastic regulations to limit the number of free patients. In 1934, and this is an aggregate figure, 95,000 individuals made 718,000 visits to Chicago's six largest clinics. And one of the social workers reported that this represents a city as large as Cincinnati. Provident Hospital on the city's south side had literally expanded to the curb and has to turn dozens away daily. The Central Free Dispensary on the west side is taking 500 a day and has reached the limit of its capacity. So where were all these crowds coming from? Most of the new patients were people who had probably never previously considered attending a clinic, which were supposed to be for the poorest of poor and had really a stigma attached to them. So this is really a whole new category of patient. This clinic crisis, this overcrowding, tells us something about what the Depression did to the ability of working people to pay for medical care. But it also, and I think very importantly, shows us what medical care meant to people and what lengths they were willing to go to get access to the care that they felt they needed. This huge surge in clinic usage, I found, occurred despite of how difficult it was to get care. It's not as if the clinics were throwing open their doors and saying, come on in, we can serve the victims of the depression. It was really quite the opposite. There were a lot of barriers for people to get care. Some of the barriers were geographic. The vast majority of Chicago's clinics were located very close to the Loop in the downtown area, so the majority of working and poor people had to travel pretty significant distances to reach them. In one example, the Chicago Daily News described a woman who had to leave her home at 6 a.m. to get to a clinic by 9, and she had to do this once a week to see a doctor for heart trouble. And once you got to the clinic, if you're able to get there, you couldn't just walk in and be expected to be seen by a doctor. Clinics usually required a referral from the Bureau of Public Welfare, and later in the decade, this would change to the Chicago Relief Administration. So you had to get a referral from a welfare agency. So new patients to clinics were required to make two trips, one from home to welfare office and one from the welfare office to the clinic, before they could be considered for admission. A patient who had previously been seen in another clinic would be refused admission unless he or she had obtained a written release from the first clinic. So there was quite a lot of paperwork, some red tape they had to go through. Also, any patient who had previously been treated by a private doctor or hospital for their condition was required to show a referral. So, and just imagine, like in the days before there was really extensive phone service, all of these releases and referrals had to be obtained physically by the patient and then presented in person at the clinic. The next hurdle faced once you actually got there was getting to see a doctor. Most clinics did not offer appointments and simply required patients to wait to be seen on a first-come, first-serve basis. So sometimes it was not possible to be seen on the same day or even during the same week. Patients had to leave and return later, often much later. In one study, they found that about 75% of the clients showing up at a clinic with a referral were seen by physicians on the same day, but the other 25% had to wait between 1 and 4 weeks before being able to see a doctor. And these delays in treatment were exacerbated by the tradition that I already mentioned of keeping very limited hours in the clinics. Since physicians worked there without pay, they could only offer their services a few hours a week. So opening times of, for example, 9 to 1, 9 to 11, or 2 to 4, just 2 or 3 days a week, were standard at many facilities. Outpatient departments might offer clinics for certain disorders only once a month, depending on the availability of specialists. And most clinics were only open during the workday, which created another important barrier to care. I found some examples of patients who were interviewed about why they never came back for follow-up care. And one explained, I could not take the time away from my work. There was a case of a woman who waited with a sick child at the Children's Memorial Clinic. Finally, she told the staff she had to leave. She had to get back to work. The staff told her to return at a later date, but she decided that she would be unable to wait long enough for the child to see the doctor. And this woman ended up going to a private physician and owing him over $100. Once they got through the door of the clinic, patients faced long waits of several hours in very crowded conditions. There was a lot of reports in the papers at the time of the conditions in the waiting rooms. One report described waiting rooms so crowded that patients must stand up while waiting to see a doctor and then must stand again in a long, slow line to get the medication that had been prescribed. At one clinic, patients remained standing in line throughout the lunch hour when the registration desk was closed for fear of losing their place. A headache patient gave up on her treatments because the clinic she attended was always crowded, and she disliked having to wait each time she went. And in one particularly dramatic story, one day in the waiting room of the Mandel Clinic of Michael Reese Hospital, a 19-year-old boy began screaming and demanding to be seen immediately. Admissions workers later found out that the young man's pregnant sister had fainted after waiting for 4 hours at the prenatal clinic at Mandel. So on top of all this, patients faced the possibility of being rejected outright for medical care. It's not surprising to tell you that many Chicago clinics discriminated based on race. In 1934, 6 out of 32 city clinics reported that they did not admit African Americans. Others had explicit quotas for African American patients, and they were, like I said, very explicit about this, and the Council of Social Agencies even kept track of which patients, which clinics had racial quotas without really any critique of that. They just kept track of it. So if the racial quota had been met, a clinic would then direct any African American patients to Provident Clinic on the South Side, or they would just simply refuse care altogether. In addition to race, there were other ways that patients could be rejected from clinics. And in fact, admissions and rejections were such a big part of the clinic's work that the Council of Social Agencies had a whole subcommittee devoted solely to those issues of admissions and rejections. Applicants at clinics underwent an admissions interview lasting from a few minutes to up to 20 minutes or more to determine their income level and eligibility. And this is definitely this is done mostly by social workers. This is a kind of interesting way that social workers were employed during the 30s. And they were also the ones who would visit the family home to determine their budget and if they had enough money to pay a doctor. And these types of standards and these types of budget determinations became even more important to the clinics because in the middle of the Depression, the Chicago Medical Society was getting increasingly concerned about, as I said, what they saw as competition from the clinics. So they released a study claiming that there were numerous cases of patients abusing the free clinics, and these were people who supposedly could afford a private doctor. So due to pressure from the medical profession, the clinics agreed that they would be more stringent in their admissions requirements. As the demand for clinic care increased throughout the Depression, people were increasingly rejected not just for ineligibility, but because there was simply no room for them. By the summer of 1938, Grant Hospital reported that its clinics can accept no more cases in general medical or cardiac clinics, and the prenatal services have appointments scheduled into the fall. At Mandel Clinic, appointments were being made 2 and 3 weeks in advance, and patients are being rejected beyond these appointments. And at Northwestern, some 40 patients a day are rejected because clinic capacity has been reached. So clearly there was a huge amount of stress on the clinic system. What was the response of Chicago's charity workers and policymakers to this crisis? The Council of Social Agencies formed a new committee to seek compensation from the state to care for those patients who cannot pay for their services. And this was a major change for Chicago agencies, which had previously relied to a great extent on city and county help to help supplement private support, but never the state. This was really something new for them to go to Illinois. And new types of funding, as elsewhere in the Depression, did begin to come in. At first, the Illinois Emergency Relief Commission, which was the state relief agency, began to channel some funds to Chicago's clinics in 1932. And clinics even briefly received some federal funds the following year through FDR's emergency relief allocations. This was really quite temporary because work relief replaced emergency cash relief to the states with the creation of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, and the WPA funding did not include any provision for medical care, either for workers to pay for their medical care or any direct subsidy to providers. But even though this state support was very limited, having had a taste of it, Chicago's charity establishment began to insist that the clinics were deserving of government subsidy, specifically due to the economic emergency that they were experiencing. The newly employed had lost everything because of factors beyond their control. In the words of the charity workers, they had been rendered indigent by society. Therefore, it was now the duty of society rather than private charity to care for their needs. So, even though, as we know, FDR did not include health care in the Social Security Act, I think that these stories tell us that the Depression did help pave the way for new types of government financing for safety net institutions. Providers of care to the indigent, including the clinics that I've described, emerged from the Depression with new expectations of reimbursement by state and local governments, and this paved the way for new forms of state and federal funding in the 1940s and 50s. And I don't have time to go into detail about that today, and I really wanted to just throw in a question here at the end, since this is what I'm really struggling with as I write my book. Where does this leave rights for patients? Did the Depression lead to a new understanding of rights to access? And if we look just at national policy, we have to say no, because of the exclusion of health care from Social Security. But I think if we look at the local level, we see a very mixed answer to that question. We see that providers and even municipalities, places like Chicago, received greater rights to state support for the work they were doing to treat safety net patients. But I do not see a corresponding increase in the obligation of either cities or institutions to provide that care. So the way I'm looking at it is that I see that providers gain some rights to reimbursement, but they do not gain a corresponding obligation to expand the safety net or to open it up to more people. But although patients themselves did not obtain new rights to access emerging out of this crisis, I still see the Depression as a time when demands for health care became a matter for public concern. And this is not because patients were deliberately organizing or making speeches. I actually, you know, have been searching the archives and newspapers for some examples. And during some of the unemployed marches in Chicago, they did refer to medical care. There were some signs and banners that unemployed workers carried, you know, demanding access to medical care, but I didn't find a specific organization or movement in Chicago devoted solely to this issue, apart from the example that I mentioned. But I still think that by coming in such large numbers to the clinics, that Chicago's unemployed were in a way making a collective statement about the importance of medical care to them. They collectively sent a message about both the importance and the inadequacy of the healthcare safety net in Chicago. Thank you very much.